Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Welcome to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Zaltzberg, editor of the Herald Times in Bloomington, along with Mary Catherine Carmichael. And today we're going to talk with author Luis Alberto Urrea. If you have questions or comments, please phone us at 855-0811 or 877-285-9348. Or you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. Before we get started, let me give you a little background on our guests. Luis just arrived after a drive from Chicago. He made it in here about 2 minutes before the show started, so we haven't had a lot of time to visit. But I'm looking very, very much forward to this conversation today. Luis is the author of 11 works of fiction. You just completed your 12th. Is that correct?
I'm working on one.
Working on your 12th.
So I'm on the 13th,
and you're
13. I guess.
When you're not flying, you're writing.
Right.
These are works of fiction, nonfiction, short stories, and poetry. In 2005, he was a Pulitzer Prize finalist and American Book Award winner for his book, The Devil's Highway. His bestseller, The Hummingbird's Daughter, is the fictionalized account of his great aunt's life during the Mexican Civil War. He's going to be speaking tonight at the Buskirk Chumley Theater, 7 o'clock. As a guest of the Friends of the Library, his talk is called Magical Realism, Immigration, and Life on the Border. So that's the intro. Welcome.
Thanks, Bob.
Right. Thanks for being here. The book that that we're going to talk about a little bit today, The Devil's Highway, is the one that you were a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize with, and that's the account of 26 men trying to cross the Mexican border into the desert of southern Arizona in the year 2001. If you just read the beginning page of Devil's Highway, you'll not want to let it go. It is a gripping beginning. It's sort of horrifying, actually.
Well, it is. It's one of my editors jokingly called it the perfect dust storm, you know, because in essence it's a story of what they call men in peril books. And in fact, when I first talked to the publishing company about it, it was proposed to me as a men in peril book, you know, this terrible story where these men face these terrible odds and many of them die a grisly death. But what they wanted was for the book to function as a kind of Trojan horse, in that you show this drama, you show this tragedy, but you also try to teach the American reading public what is going on the border and what some of the border milieu is about, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was a really interesting challenge for me.
Uh-huh. So did you take their challenge and sort of adjust it to the way that you wanted to tell the story?
Well, you know, it was weird because I didn't know how to approach it really, and they didn't really have anything in mind. They just said, write the perfect Luis book. And I thought, wow, really? Whatever I want?
And then where do you go from there if you write the perfect
book? Yeah, what
book?
Do you do? Yeah. You know, and I really didn't know how to approach it. Like I said, and one of the things I knew I had to do was to get close to the Border Patrol. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I had a lot of ingrained prejudice about the Border Patrol. You know, I was born in Mexico, raised in the U.S. I won't indict anybody, but I might have family members who came over here illegally, possibly. And, you know, so I went into that not quite knowing what I would find. And they really weren't interested in having me come in their world and write about them. Hmm. And, you know, at the time, it didn't occur to me that this was such a controversial story. But it was the largest single death event on the border to date. It was the largest Border Patrol manhunt and rescue in history to date. And it was an ongoing trial, civil lawsuit and investigation. And at the same time, the Tucson sector of the Border Patrol was under investigation for some misbehavior by some of their agents. All that being said, the other thing it didn't really occur to me was that if you go to any kind of police station in the world and walk in and tell the beat cops, hey, pal, I'm going to come in and write a book about all your secrets. Okay.
Yeah, right.
They're going to say, no, not okay. And they didn't – they were not interested, and it took 4 months of courting. Mm-hmm. And I was really lucky, you being an editor. My wife's an investigative journalist.
Okay.
And when I was denied over and over again, I took the poet's recourse, which is to go in your room and put on some Black Sabbath records really loud and, you know, moan and groan. But she did what reporters do, are trained to do, which is face the opposition and keep at them. Mm-hmm. And so she started calling around the country and just by happenstance called Yuma, Arizona. And the Yuma Border Patrol station guy said, yeah, send him down. We thought, wait a minute. We've been denied by Tucson. We've been denied by the Washington Bureau. We've been denied by all of them. And these guys in Yuma said, sure. So we thought, wow, we better get down there before they realize their mistake and stop me.
Yeah.
And I went down there and it was a very interesting experience. You know, it took a little bit of hazing for them to let me enter. And, you know, it was a really – I think probably one of the most stunning moments for me as a person and as a writer in my life to get close to these Border Patrol agents and to realize that I had – you know, I always tell people – it makes people mad, but I think it's true that there's nobody more sort of bigoted and prejudiced than a good liberal. You know, we're just more self-righteous about it. Mm-hmm. And I went down there thinking I was going to write a book about humanity, but I had all this prejudice about the Border Patrol. And it would have been a terrible book if I had not been forced – and it was really an act of grace, I think, to be forced to see these guys who for what they really were, who they really were. And that was a miracle for me.
Did you ever find out why they let you into their ranks?
Mm-hmm. I think because this event was so bad, it haunted these agents so much that they wanted it told. In fact, every level of help that I sought, Mexican government was not necessarily eager to have people peer into their secrets either.
Mm-hmm.
The consular corps, the sheriff's department, all of the people who were involved in this crisis were so disturbed by it and upset by it that they all wanted things revealed and told. And our mistake had been to go to the official channels, which mm-hmm. was go to Washington, which said, no, we really can't do this. Go to Tucson, which turned out to really not be the Border Patrol station that did the actual search.
Mm.
So these guys in Yuma were kind of cowboys, and I mean that in the good sense of cowboys. If you meet Sheriff Ogden, I'll be doing a talk at UC Davis after Thanksgiving with the Yuma County Sheriff, and he is the real deal cowboy, 10-foot tall, giant, lonesome dove, white mustache, 10-gallon hat. They're not going to know what to do at UC Davis when he shows up. So they were really moved. And the interesting thing is when I was there with them, one of the agents said to me, look, you shouldn't even be here. You should go to Welton Station. They're the guys who actually did the rescue. But I'm going to warn you, he said, those guys are politically incorrect. And I thought, thank God, you know, finally somebody might talk to me. And he took me out there to this little podunk station, 32 agents. When I walked in there, it was like hyenas closing in, you know, on a baked ham.
Those and dudes, you were the ham.
I was the ham. They saw me walk in and these guys started to rise from their various desks with these smiles of, oh my God. We're going to tear this guy apart. I was wearing an earring, you know. They're looking at me like, oh, come here, kid, you know. And they gave me a really hard time. And the first agent who spoke to me was a guy named McPherson who happened to be Mexican. I didn't know he was a Mexican agent. I thought he was Italian. He had a little mustache, and Agent McPherson, and he told me if he showed up in my book, I was not allowed to use his name. And I said, well, what do you want me to call you? And he said, call me Officer Friendly. And I was just, oh, my God, these guys are going to kill me. And they were giving me just the worst time. And there's a supervisory agent there who's become one of my best friends in the world, oddly enough, Kenny Smith. And he came out of the back and he was watching all this and he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm trying to write this book. And Officer Friendly said, he's writing about the Yuma 14. who were the 14 guys who died. And I didn't know that Kenny was the supervisory agent at the time and had started the run to go save them. And he just looked at me and he said, I can help you with that.
Wow.
I said, come back to the control center. And the other guy said, you can't take him back there. And he said, I'm the supervisory agent. I can take him if I want to. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, by, again, grace, that's all I can imagine, he takes me into the control center and he sits me in a corner and they go back to their business. So I thought the yeah. smartest thing I can do is stay quiet and just sit here in the corner, be invisible, let them forget I'm here and just watch their world. And, you know, the second day, the agent that was with him who runs the computers, a guy named Jerry Wofford, turns to me and says, so Yuma 14. I said, yes, sir. He said, come here. And I moved over and he went to the computer and he started calling up the death scene videos.
Oh, my gosh.
Of each of the deaths. He took me through all 14 deaths, which was overwhelming. And I thought, I've got my material, you know. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't take notes. I'd excuse myself to the restroom yeah. and then write like crazy because I thought, you know, it's going to make people feel
sure.
studied. Yeah. And Kenny Smith – I think we realized we really liked each other, but we were both a little cautious, obviously. And after Wofford showed me the videos, he said, well, you need to actually go there. I said, I know, but it's on federal land. It's a bombing range, so you can't get on there. The Marines won't let you on. And he said, well, if you can be here tomorrow at 7, I'll take you. So I came back. You know,
yeah.
a reporter mm-hmm. gets a shot like that.
Yeah, yeah. You don't say, no, I'm not getting up till 8.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right. yeah.
You say it's better for me. Yeah.
Got to get a wake-up call because yeah. I had to drive 50 miles to get to him. Yeah. And sure enough, you know, he took me on the bombing range. And when we were alone away from the station, two guys in the desert, and he starts showing his love. And his love was amazing to me because it began with a love for the land. He starts teaching me how he tracks. And he starts teaching me how they can read the soil. And being a writer and a professor of writing, I thought, my God, this guy is – he's like a critic of landscape. This guy he started telling me how he knows what time somebody walked through. It was brilliant. And the first thing that happened was he stopped the truck and I thought I was still being razzed, okay? And he looks in the distance and he says, oh, there's nobody up in that cave. And I looked, you know, and there's this little stinking rat hole 5 miles away. And so I laughed and I said, all right, you've got X-ray vision, right? You can see in the cave. And he said, no. He said, but I know that cave and it's not deep enough for a human body to fit in. So when people go up to that cave, they pile rocks or brush in front of the mouth to try to hide better. So if it's not round, I know there's somebody in there.
Hmm.
Who would have guessed that?
Yeah.
And, you know, so we're out walking around. He's showing me all this tracking stuff. And we walk on the Devil's Highway itself, which is an actual dirt road through the desert. He walks me to the Mexican border. There's nothing there. I mean, unless you go and you really realize that the only thing there is maybe every few miles a little tin sign that says, don't come over here. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. And we start talking. And I will never forget it, you know, when he finally opened his heart. And the thing that really changed the whole book for me was he said, you know, my daddy was a rancher. I'm a rancher. He said, I come down here every day and I chase ranchers and farmers. Mm-hmm. He said, so part of me really understands that I'm chasing my own people. Mm-hmm. And it began there. And this incredible outpouring of humanity. You know, he said at one point, a lot of people call me a jackbooted thug. He said, I am your jackbooted thug in shining armor. Mm-hmm. He said, I get up every morning and know that I have to come here and I have to do a job in which I pursue people who have broken the law by the very fact of their being here. At the same time, I come here to save civilians who are dying a horrible death. And he said, they're often the same people. Mm-hmm. So what am I when I come? Am I a rescuer or am I police? What do I do? He said, it's so schizophrenic that a lot of the agents make it a point of living quite a distance from the station so that they can have, you know, get into the game and then try to get out of the game going back home He said it's really hard to go home and hold your daughter on your knee after a day of this stuff, you know.
Very interesting.
So it was amazing.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll get back to I want to hear more about, you know, that book and your process for that. We do have a phone call. The numbers, again, are 855-0811, 877-285-9348, and noon at indiana.edu. And our phone call comes from Karen. Karen?
Hello.
Hello, Karen. Go ahead.
Well, I'm calling to, much as I enjoyed The Devil's Highway, and I'm going to enjoy hearing more about it, but I have a personal question. And that is that Mr. Urrea wrote about his father's diligence with him speaking perfect Spanish. And so the question is, are your children bilingual? And is that a goal for your family that you continue that bilingual Spanish and English?
Thanks, Karen.
With fluency. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I have three kids. My two eldest kids are stepkids. They're teenagers. So they were already, you know, fully English-speaking American kids. We have a daughter who's seven, Rosario Teresa, also known as Chayo. And, you know, it's a little difficult in that I'm the only Spanish speaker anywhere around us in Naperville, Illinois. So between myself, you know, her school and her interest in TV and music, she is very interested in Spanish. So I'm going to try with her as best I can. Interestingly enough, my middle daughter is now taking Spanish in school. So it's really funny. They say hi to each other in Spanish. Hola, chica. It's like that, which is kind of funny. But you know, my dad's, I think, insistence on Spanish was partially a product of a war between him and my mom being American. And they had a terrible marriage that had fallen apart. And so we had this armed camp. You know, one half of the apartment was always Mexican and the other half was American, and they slept in different rooms. And so, you know, I have a natural affinity for this border stuff because I was not only born there but raised, you know, on the border fence between Mexico and the United States, even in my living room.
Yeah. Your father was Mexican. Your mother was American.
Yeah.
You lived in Tijuana.
Yeah.
When you were young. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She was actually – I'll talk about this tonight some, but, you know, she had come back from World War II. She'd been a Red Cross lady and, you know, basically had fled New York City and gone to Sausalito to live on a houseboat, as many post-war people did. I think after World War II, she was not quite a beat, but more a sort of eccentric late Victorian. And yeah. She met my dad and was whisked off to the, you know, exotic – climate of Tijuana. I think she thought she was going to a hacienda, not a dirt street. You know?
Our guest today is Luis Alberto Urrea. He is speaking tonight at the Buskirk Chumley Theater as a guest of the Friends of the Library. His talk tonight is Magical Realism, Immigration, and Life on the Border.
You talk in your bio that you provided us, you talk about your...
He didn't provide that. I found that.
Oh, you found that.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm not sure he's too happy I found it either.
You talk about your reticence to go back to grad school and finish up, and you finally broke down and did that. You said it
right.
Took 20 years. What was standing in your way?
Well, my father was killed in my senior year of college, actually, at the hands of the Mexican cops. And it was this horrible experience, protracted and grisly. And when it was over, I kind of made my way through the last bits of my senior year. And I thought, there's no way I can do that. I can't go on. Mm-hmm. So I did all the kind of weird Southern California things you can do to get out of college. I was a movie extra, you know.
What have you been in?
I was in The Stuntman with Peter O'Toole.
All right.
I was in A Force of One with Chuck Norris. That was good. Anyway, I was a graveyard shift clerk at 7-Eleven and all this ridiculous stuff. But in 1978, I joined a missionary group and began working in Mexico with the poor. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, set fire to my entire world. And I was there for years as a translator for this group. And in the early 80s, through some bizarre happenstance, which I still don't quite understand, I was hired to teach expository writing at Harvard. So I went from Tijuana to Harvard, which is really bizarre.
A little culture shock,
unbelievable.
Maybe? Oh, my gosh.
Unbelievable. But all this, you know, it's just life intervened. And I kept thinking I was going to be a famous author. I didn't know that that wasn't necessarily going to happen immediately. And so in 1990, I realized, wow, it's been a long time and I'm not famous yet. I'm not even published yet. So maybe I'll go to grad school so I can teach English. And that's, you know, so I went back to graduate school and that's when I sold my first book. So it messed up grad school even then. I
just couldn't stay in school.
I couldn't stay in school. It's too much to do.
Yeah. All right. We have an email.
Oh, yeah, we do. It begins, I tried to get into magical realism in literature many times over the years. It just doesn't speak to me, and I give up. Do you have any tips for readers about learning to appreciate magical realism?
Magical realism. Well, you know,
I don't even know what magical realism means.
Yeah, I'm not sure anybody really does. You know, I mean, is Ray Bradbury magical realism? One could make an argument, or Ursula Le Guin. I don't know.
I don't know, but it's in the title of your presentation tonight.
Yeah, I know.
Maybe you should figure that out.
That wasn't my title.
Oh,
okay. They gave me that title. They wanted me to give a title, and I forgot, so they gave it a title.
Oh, okay.
Magical realism. I'll tell you the funny thing for me, for example, with The Hummingbird's Daughter, which is the big novel, which is much of what I'll be talking about tonight. It's a historical novel. It took me 20 years of research to write this book. It's now being made into a movie, and I'm not allowed to tell you who's acting in it, unfortunately, though I will say Puss in Boots, if you've seen Shrek. That's obvious. But
nicely played.
Thank you so much. But, my agent would go crazy, but he's in L.A. He'll never know. Anyway, you know, the thing about the book is that it seems quite magical because the woman it's about is my great aunt. She was known as the Saint of Cabora. And she was actually a midwife and a medicine woman of her tribe who began giving evidence of touch healing. Hmm. And she was so huge and began such a movement that her ranch was the permanent camp for 10,000 pilgrims trying to get to her. So when I was working on this novel, like I said, 20 years of research, 10 years of that with shamans, medicine women, curanderas, healers. So I always tell people I spent 10 years in the library archives and then 10 years in the Twilight Zone with people who, you know, I mean, again, my wife being a reporter, you guys are hard-headed types, you know, and she's learned to just shrug it off. We get an email from a cousin and says, I woke up this morning levitating 18 inches above the bed. And I say, you know, hey, honey, guess what? You know, cousin Bernie's levitating. He says, oh, yes, of course she is. So you deal with that sort of a world and that sort of a view where anything is possible, okay? When I turned in the manuscript to my publisher, they began editing out all this crazy stuff. And at a certain point, I finally had to call him in New York and say, you know what's really funny about this? This is a historical novel. Yeah, absolutely. I said, well, you're cutting all the history out.
Mm-hmm.
I said, the stuff that's made up is what did they eat for breakfast?
Right. Mm-hmm.
What kind of pants did they wear? I said, all of the amazing stuff in this is stuff that's actually witnessed and in the record. So for me, the magical realism almost doesn't fit because this is kind of the reverse. It was something full of wonders. And I have to say I've spoken all over the country. I have a lot of friends from Indiana. I don't think the stuff in these books is that distantly removed from things that you know and anybody knows. People come to me and say, wow, I wish I had culture like that. And I say, really? You know, what's your family roots? Oh, you know, we're just German or we're just Irish or we're just Polish. I was like, are you crazy? You think you don't have a folk tradition? You're crazy if you don't think so. I think we could leave the studio right now and go find an old timer somewhere who would tell us some amazing cure for warts, you know, or, you know, like people can sense rain coming in their hip or there's a water witch somewhere. I think at least for the terms of my book, it was about understanding and honoring the beliefs of the old timers because they all died in the turn of the century, so they would really be old-timers if they were here now, their belief system and the way they saw the world, which was full of grace and holiness. Everything was sacred to them. Everything was sacred. Mm-hmm. As far as magical realism, for example, Garcia Marquez, he tells this story, which I think is a wonderful story. He used to say, you know, when I was a little boy, there was a guy that was famous for curing cattle of worms. And so he came to do a healing, and I went to see this. And he said the guy stood in front of the cow and essentially put his hand out and yelled, "Worms, come out." And the cow vomited the worms out. And he said, you know, once you've actually seen something like that, what's so weird about, you know, Cousin Bernie levitating, mm-hmm. right? So I think it's a way to try to honor the fantastic and the dream as well as the daily reality, to take it all as part of what's there. And I tend to believe that all life in a way is magic realism. I mean, I don't want to be religious, but I think that's how God works. I think I'm surrounded by miracles constantly. I just don't see them anymore because I'm trying to get to your radio show and hoping cops.
That was a miracle.
Watching for cops, trying not to get caught. You know, we are too busy to see the miracles because the miracles are small. And I think sometimes those writers find some way to try to raise the focus on it a little bit, bring up the color a little bit like your TV. Mm-hmm. That's what I think is going on.
All right. Our phone numbers again, 855-0811, 877-285-9348. And you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. We've hit halftime in the program.
Wow.
Luis Alberto Urrea is our guest. We'll be back for about another half an hour. You're listening to Noon Edition.
You're listening to Noon Edition on member-supported WFIU. Production support comes from Closets 2, providing organized and expanded closet and storage space for home office and garage, using a variety of systems with no major renovations. Closets 2 owned and operated in Bloomington, 332-2233. And from South Dunn Street Project, represented by Brian Lappin Real Estate, classic bungalow-inspired architecture in the Bryan Park neighborhood of Bloomington, www.southdunstreet.info. WFIU joins arts organizations in our area as a media sponsor. The Kokomo Community Concerts present 2005 Van Cliburn competition finalist David Kabasi performing works of Schubert, Debussy, and Brahms this evening at Kokomo High School Auditorium at 7:30. The Lawrence County Concert Association presents a bluegrass concert by Special Consensus with their guests, the Not Too Bad Bluegrass Band, this evening at Bedford North Lawrence High School at 7:30. And Saturday evening, the Columbus, Indiana Philharmonic presents Bach to Germany under the direction of David Bowden, Bach's Mass in B minor at 7:30 at Columbus North High School Auditorium. More about these and many others on our website at wfiu.org.
Welcome back to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Salzberg from the Herald Times, along with Mary Catherine Carmichael and our guest today, Luis Alberto Urrea. Luis is the author of 11 works of fiction. No, he's working on his 13th work
right.
of fiction, nonfiction, short stories, and poetry. 2005, he was a Pulitzer Prize finalist and the American Book Award winner for his book, The Devil's Highway, which we've talked about some and we'll talk about more. His current bestseller, The Hummingbird's Daughter, is a fictionalized account of his great aunt's life during the Mexican Civil War. He'll be speaking tonight at the Buskirk Chumley Theater at 7 o'clock. He's a guest of the Friends of the Library. And based on our first half hour, I think you should rush out there and see this.
What a great evening.
All right. I did want to just mention Teresa, your daughter. You say it Teresa?
Teresa.
And your great aunt had the same name.
Right.
Is your daughter named after your great aunt?
Yeah, partially. Okay. She's named after my godmother. His name Rosario Garcia. We used to call her Mama Chayo. Chayo is a nickname for Rosario. It's one of those odd things. S names reduced down to CH sounds.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Jesus is Chewy. So
okay.
People who are being familiar with God and funny, you know, yeah. call Jesus Chewy too. So Chayo is Rosario. And it's hilarious in Naperville because they just can't figure out Chayo, so people call her Child. Like we have a generic daughter, you know, with a little barcode on her.
Yeah. Child Urea.
There's our other one, Kid. Yeah, right. Our daughter, yeah. Child, and yeah. Our son, Kid.
Now, Luis has mentioned Naperville a couple of times. You're teaching at the University of Chicago?
University of Illinois.
University of Illinois.
Yeah, Chicago.
In Chicago. Okay. I wanted to ask you about – go back to the Devil's Highway briefly because I'm fascinated by this story. You have 26 men who tried to come into the U.S. and 14 of them wind up dead.
Yeah.
12 of them live. Your description, you know, early on in the book of just the Devil's Highway,
yeah. I mean,
that region that they were trying to go through as a place that even the Border Patrol guards didn't want to go. I mean, they don't even want to go there. You went in there, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like?
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're Edward Abbey or somebody like that, you know, he in fact wrote about it often. It's a beautiful but forbidding place, and it's an ancient place. The actual path that became the Camino del Diablo is an ancient hunting path. It was an animal trail first, and the old tribes, the pre-conquest tribes, walked through there. Papago, Apache, Yaqui, all these tribes, Pima. But it's always been a very dark place. It's got a kind of an occult history. It's kind of frightening in those ways. I talk in the book. So many unexpected things came up for me. I found out the first white man to die on that road died in 1516. He was a Spanish conqueror, and there were no records kept of death because indigenous people didn't write books. But from that guy's death, Melchior Diaz, to the present, there has been a record, and there have been hundreds upon hundreds of deaths always in this same place. It was one of the pathways that people headed for the gold rush, mm-hmm. for the gold mines, and died. And there were Indian wars there. It's just a very eerie place. And it passes through some really rugged, rugged terrain. It starts east of Tucson, and it goes all the way west to the Colorado River. I know Cormac McCarthy is hot stuff, especially with No Country for Old Men coming up. But if you ever read his novel Blood Meridian, which may be the most demonic novel ever, certainly one of the bloodiest novels ever written, the climax of that novel, it's basically a true story, happens at the terminus of the Devil's Highway, interestingly enough. Uh-huh. So it's just always been this dark, bloody terrain. And these men really had not intended to come to the United States. I felt that, you know, Americans don't necessarily – neither do Mexicans, by the way, know what the mechanism is to bring people over. I always joke with audiences that – you know, people just assume that Mexicans have some gene that goes off at like 13 and says, "Oh, must go to the United States and I know how to go." It's like migrating geese. It's not like that. And, you know, people in Guadalajara know as little about the border as people right here in Bloomington. But they find out, you know, out of desperation. And these guys were in Veracruz, and they were mostly – they were all, you know, subsistence level people, not doing real well. But they were – they could survive. They had little – plots of land. Most of them did sharecropping of coffee, and the coffee prices dropped and they suddenly had nothing. And Veracruz historically is one of the last states in Mexico to send people north because they were making it. At least they had the coffee or the fishery to rely on. These organizations that have taken over the border now are criminal organizations structured much like the cocaine and marijuana smugglers, okay? And on a really evil level, the white slavers, the human trade. And they have recruiters. And they call them hookers, oddly enough. But hookers as in fishing, enganchador. And they sent this guy, Don Moy, Moses, oddly enough, into Veracruz to recruit these men. And what the evil trick is when they recruit is that they charge this huge amount for these men to be transported. The men can't obviously afford that or they'd stay home. Mm-hmm. So the criminal organization, quote, makes a loan of the money to these walkers to bring them to the United States and place them in a job. And then they have to repay their debt. And it's, you know, it's at a high interest rate. These are men who've never had a credit card. And suddenly they're paying 15 to 20 to 25% interest compounded monthly. They don't know what that means. Mm-hmm. And so they get to these places to work and find out that they are now slaves to the organization that brought them, which is what these guys basically fell into. They were brought north, and the guide that was going to bring them into the United States never showed. He apparently partied too hard, you know, on that Friday night, didn't show up on Saturday morning. And this kid, 19-year-old kid, very macho, basically said, I can do it. I'll lead him. And he took him and got lost.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 855-0811-876. I'm sorry, 877-285-9348 and noon at indiana.edu. You know, you described earlier how you had some preconceived notions about the border border patrol that turned out to not be true. But I would also think that you, going into this, at least as you were finding out more and more about what actually was happening, that these people are not nice people that are are doing this. So what kind of you know, what kind of I don't know, fear did that bring to you? Did you get into dangerous situations?
Oh yeah. They should be happy that I'm not king because there would be heads on spikes if I were king. Uh-huh. You know, it was very odd because you think of yourself as boring suburban dad with the kids and driving the kids to school. We live on Leave It to Beaver Street, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Seriously, walk the little girl to the bus stop and there's a wild turkey that lives on our street, so all the neighbors take care of the turkey. So he's watching us from behind the neighbor's house, and there's a friendly FBI guy who drives off to work, and everybody waves at the FBI. It's honestly, Beaver Cleaver could live on our street. Then you find yourself down here in the desert with these maniacs, you know, who are doing things to people. You would not believe the level of evil, and it is evil what they're doing to people. And I'm not going to say every coyote is like that because they're not. There are guys who take pride in whatever it is they do. But there are so many low-down, wicked, evil people living off suffering and pain. And you know, if you're sick, they will leave you to die. You know, they do things that I can't even repeat on the air. So yeah, that's really disconcerting. And during the year I investigated this story, I was told three times I would be killed.
And how were you told? How did you get those messages?
Warnings from law enforcement. Uh-huh. Interestingly.
Yeah. Did they own law enforcement? Did they?
Oh no.
People off?
Oh well, I'm sure they do. You know, somebody once said to me, if you were a Border Patrol agent, you're making whatever salary, and some guy steps up to your van and says, I have 100 people here and I'll give you $500 each to not look for 20 minutes. What would you do? Hmm. I thought, wow. And at the time I thought this was really incendiary anti-Border Patrol rhetoric until I found out that the Border Patrol agents are routinely ordered not to catch people. They will head for a place. They know there are people and they're told, oh no, today you just go over here. And they will tell the boss, but wait a minute, we caught 1,200 people here this weekend and there'll be more. And they say, no, you've got to, knowing full well what that means, go elsewhere. So all the agents I've gotten to know are ironists and slightly paranoid because they've seen a massive, gigantic thing going on that nobody can quite grasp, but it's beyond them and it's beyond us to understand, I think, how big this is. I've seen a letter telling them not to apprehend people because they needed pickers in the Imperial Valley. So it's this very odd dance that these agents have to do. And I have to say, you know, again, I was not only surprised by them, but I was surprised, for example, by the Mexican Consular Corps. I have family in the Mexican government, yet I had an opinion, like we all do, what the Mexican government must be like. Yet I met these people and they were the most precise, professional, you know, with it, progressive people I've ever met. And I was stunned. And they have to work under the radar, just like I think the Border Patrol agents often have to work under the radar. And as the rescue people who go out and save the lost work under the radar, and even the lawyers who are trying to work on this problem also. And again, at every level, they all wanted to share. It was the most remarkable thing. And I, you know, it just slayed me. For example, one of the lawyers who gave me material that was priceless and no one has ever seen it but other lawyers and me. You know, he didn't have to do that, but he again was so moved by what he had seen, he wanted to tell the story.
All right, 855-0811, 877-285-9348. And you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu.
All right, this is going to strike you as a crazy question, but I just have to know your opinion on the fence across.
The fence.
I can't help myself.
I don't know about the fence, you know. I don't know. I'm sure you've seen this new thing where some of the mayors of Brownsville and so forth in Texas said, don't build the fence, widen the river, which I think is really interesting. Dredge out the river. You know, the fence, you're talking about almost 3,000 miles of border. And you're talking about funding 700 miles of it, for which they really are going to fund maybe between 300 and 500 miles, but they could – lately have been saying, well, they'll be able to put up 70 miles of fence. And, you know, this is a multiple billion-dollar operation of your tax money. It's supposed to be a double-layer high-tech fence, and the parts of the fence that are up have been single-layer. They're not even – so you've got about 30 miles of single-layer chain-link fence, part of which in Arizona was put up by undocumented workers – i.e. illegal aliens built it. Now in Texas, part of the fence is cut across one of the university playing fields and they've given the soccer field to Mexico. So, you know, if the fence will work, great. You know, I'm all for it. I don't know that it will work. It doesn't seem to be working. And if you go into those regions, you'll see that there's no way to build fences up and down mountain ranges. I don't know that that can happen. So I'm curious to see how this will play out. You know, there's a lot of work going on with the virtual fence, which I think is very interesting. Part of the problem they have is immense environmental damage that's happening because of the walkers, and even more so because of the cars. And in some regions in Arizona, they're messing around with these car barriers. Because the problem is if you put up the fence, then it stops migration of animals and you'll lead to an ecological disaster on that level. But these car barriers can't be dug up or moved and nothing can drive through them. But they have gaps wide enough for creatures to pass through. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, sensors, infrared, watchtowers, drones. I mean, there's a lot of stuff one can do. You know, I feel bad because I always see the Border Patrol agents assaulted from the right and the left both. Mm-hmm. And they're not often honored for, you know, their insight. And we always talk about, well, we need more Border Patrol agents. But just think, since I wrote my book, there were 32 guys there when I wrote it. In the Welton Station now there are 300 agents, more, I think maybe 320, jammed in that station. They had to build a new station. There are lots of Border Patrol guys coming. But the issue is a huge one and the landscape is a rough one, you know. So it's very difficult for those agents to cover it.
Yeah. Now, the writers of the title for your presentation tonight used immigration in the title.
Right.
And, you know, you mentioned before if you were king, what you would do. Have you thought much about if you were president,
what you would do about the
issue of immigration? And obviously that's a huge issue. But you know, you just mentioned a few things that might work. But I mean, what's sort of your take on this great big immigration issue?
It is such an overwhelming and baffling topic. I have a blog at my website. Most of the week I spend talking about writerly stuff and poetry and blah, blah, blah. But on Mondays we put up an Immigration Monday, which is sort of like my electronic immigration newsletter. And it's been interesting because I've had Border Patrol agents write essays. I had the Mexican consul general write an essay on immigration. And I try to make data available, pro and con. My main issue at the moment is that I like to say in this country there's a lot of inflammation and no information. You know, and believe me that part of what's going on is an information war. And that we choose the term illegal alien. You heard Dennis Kucinich maybe last night on the debate chew out Wolf Blitzer because Wolf Blitzer asked him, you know, give illegal aliens driver's license or not. And Kucinich said, I reject your definition. There's no illegal human being. They're undocumented, which I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, people – I have heard Lou Dobbs for a very long time talk about all the illegal invasion, but I've never heard anybody define for the American people what the legality is. What is the law? What kind of law is it? Where can they find that law to study it and see what the issue is? I think those things are interesting. I would like to – I would love to see, for example, a bipartisan commission like the 9/11 commission to study without fear or favor, you know, study the issue and try to deliver straight talk to the American people. I'm trying to find it myself. So, you know, on the blog, for example, every week I try to put as many websites as I can find, again, pro or con. It doesn't matter to me. I want people to be able to defend their position intelligently. You know, I always tell people on the left, there's nothing wrong with worrying about your nation's security, for God's sake, you know. And people on the right are often much more willing to talk than people on the left. So I just want to – I want to be a bridge and try to get everybody talking.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go back to writing and actually storytelling.
Yeah.
And if you don't mind, I want to ask you about your experience with NPR. You've been there's a whole – you have a whole list of NPR credits, including a This American Life credit.
Oh, yeah.
What was it like doing a story for This American Life? Could you talk about that?
That was very interesting. They came to me. There was a radio producer who came to me, who wanted to record my various shenanigans and try to put together This American Life story. And we didn't really know what Ira would find interesting or not. And so I have this thing since I've done so much work on the border that I often lead these safaris of people into – my friend Sherman Alexie once said, you know, it's dances with Mexicans, he called it. But, you know, take people into the garbage dumps of Tijuana or someplace where they would not be able to go otherwise and look around. And so they followed me in. And the hook for this story was that there was a woman living in the Tijuana garbage dump that I had known since she was 6 years old. And she was now grown up and we'd lost each other. And so we went to find her with this microphone trailing. And it turned out to be this remarkable, unexpected gift in that I found her, but I had my boy with me, my white, you know, teenaged boy, and all of the little girls in her house since we'd lost sight of each other were now these unbelievably gorgeous, hot, teenage whatever, you know. All like they'd gone from little girls to a house full of J-Los. And these J-Los swooped on my boy and took him into their embrace and took him into their world. And so it turned out to be this piece about finding out what their world was like and how it affected him. Mm-hmm. And then there was a lot of trouble editing it, and Ira was just – he and his team came in and just took it and put it together, and they were awesome. They were really nice. You know, they're very personable folks. He was a lot of fun to hang out with. Mm-hmm. And the show has – you know, it's on the archive. People listen to it. I still get mail about it.
Mm-hmm. What's it archived as? Do you know?
Yeah, it's on thislife.org, and when you go down the archives, there's a show called Trash. And so he you know, he's Ira Glass. So it was kind of a funny show where there was garbage picking, recycling, and then my story. And he – I don't know what got into him, but in his little spoken intro, he called it In Spite of the Smell, I Think I Love You. I think this is what he called it. I thought, wow, that's not what I would have called it. Yeah. But
we have about 3 minutes to go.
No, really?
Oh, yeah. We're whipping through this hour. I wanted to ask about other authors that you'd like to read. Do you recommend people? David Sedaris was here recently.
And he's always amazing.
And he always recommends
authors. Wow, let's recommend David Sedaris.
Yeah.
You know, I read so much and I love so much writing. I you know, who can't you recommend? My friend Stuart Onan's an amazing writer. He's got a wonderful new book out. I love mysteries.
Uh-huh.
I like to read James Lee Burke very much, yeah. You know. I love poetry. I read lots of poetry. The coolest thing for me doing this is that more than a pro writer, I'm a fan. Mm-hmm. So I get to meet people. You know what I mean? Yeah. I get to meet writers. And that's the best thing because – then I get all these signed books from everybody. You know?
Is there a common denominator among these writers that we hear about all the time, the ones that you meet?
There is one that lots of them are jerks. But
sorry to hear that.
But it's true because we give the best that we've got to the page often. But the people who aren't jerks are just amazing. You know, we my wife and I got to spend some time with Jane Hamilton recently and just in love with her. She's so amazing. And Frank Delaney, the Irish writer, he's an incredible. John Connolly, the Irish mystery writer, also an incredible guy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's exciting to be around people who are wrestling with the world and making something amazing of it to change your life, you know. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a list of, like, things you'd like to work on in the next three years?
Oh, yeah. I'm under contract to do the sequel to Hummingbird. I'm finishing a novel now. After that, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is that a lot of pressure when you're under contract to do something?
No, it's a relief because I spent a lot of years, you know, with nothing but minute rice to eat. So it's nice.
Yeah. Now, you're going to be speaking tonight. I want to mention again, Luis Alberto Urrea is going to be speaking at the Buskirk Chumley Theater at 7 o'clock tonight. The talk is called Magical Realism, Immigration, and Life on the Border, but we're not really sure what he's going to talk about. So
you want to talk about all those things.
Give a little preview in the next minute. We have one more minute. So.
Well, I can't help but, like I told you, you know, I'll be talking about not only my life experiences but my writing experiences, and there's no way to escape all of those topics when you talk about it. But it's really, you know, it's really a talk about the daily sacred.
Yeah. And we've talked in here a little bit during the break time about some musical interests. So maybe you'll be talking about that.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yes. Luis lived in Lafayette for a time, but it was Lafayette, Louisiana. We've discovered that. Well, we want to thank you very much for being here today. The time really flew by.
Really.
It's been a lot of fun.
So I hope that people will go tonight to the Buskirk Chumley because I guarantee you, you'll have a good time listening to Luis Alberto Urrea. For Mary Catherine Carmichael, producer Catherine Hegeman, and engineer Mike Bashkash, I'm Bob Zaltzberg. Thanks for listening.
Noon Edition is a production of WFIU and the Herald Times. A podcast of this and other WFIU programs is available at wfiu.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.